Today on the Zulu One podcast, we have a very special guest. She is internationally recognized as a pioneer of both sound and the ancestral healing movements, the author of The Mystic Spiral, Journey of the Soul, and a family constellation practitioner that combines family constellations with chant and ceremony, Jill Purse.
That was incredible. Wow.
That's one of the things that I teach in my voice healing voice workshops.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That's very similar. It has a very similar tonality to the bowl when people play the bowl. It was really incredible. Wow.
Yeah, well it has a one sound and then the harmonics, which are in tune, unlike normal music, which was retuned in the 17th century, so it was out of tune to accommodate keyboard instruments, but this is in tune, and so you get the kind of resonances that create coherence in the body and correspond to our own subtle geometry.
Have you found that when people create harmonies, it creates almost a synergistic connection, that it creates a field?
Well, that's the basis of my work. Yes, exactly. And that's why I use chant in the family constellation work, because it creates and amplifies the family and ancestral field or soul. And that's the reason I use chant.
So you use chants while to open space and during the family constellation workshop?
Well, between each person, in the beginning of the whole session and between each person, I work with sound, different kinds of sound. Yes. Group chant to create and amplify the family field, the ancestral field, so the ancestors are all on board and ready to go.
Oh, so how did you make the connection between getting the morphic field and the voice, or the communal harmony? How did you make those connections?
Well, I started many, many years ago working with the voice. I realized that as a society, we'd gone silent. And that we didn't chant anymore, we didn't sing anymore, unless you were a professional. And then professionals, the opposite of a professional is an amateur. And amateur means to love something. So it's the inference is that if you're a professional, you don't. And that's very often the case. And so in a sense, the professionals with musical literacy in the 8th century, music was hijacked by the professionals. And so everybody else was, you know, disempowered in a sense. And so gradually, you know, when I started this work, people didn't join choirs. They didn't sing. You know, they put professionals into their devices, and they put their earphones in, you know, in trying to get the sound back inside, whereas, you know, the sound needs to come from inside. And nowadays, this is all, since I started this work, it's changed. And now there are lots of amateur choirs. You don't need to have an audition or read music or all the things that you used to have to do. So when I started, you know, the world had gone silent, and I saw it as a symptom of the kind of a crazy, out of tune state of the world. And so I started doing voice workshops in the 1970s, a very long time ago, and I pioneered that whole work. And then many years later, not so many years later, as part of that work, I started doing generic ceremonies for chanting the ancestors, to honor the ancestors. And I found that this had such a profound effect. You know, people would say, other members of their family would ring up and say, what are you doing? You know, I felt something extraordinary, and people's lives would change. And it had such an extraordinary effect that I decided to, you know, go much more into detail of specific families, family members, family patterns, and patterns of exclusion. And then in the early 80s, I was teaching in Munich one time, and the person who'd organized my workshop said, oh, do you know a German called Bert Hellinger, because your work is so similar to his. So I said, no, I didn't. But I thought that was very interesting. And then much later on, Bert Hellinger got in touch with us because my husband, Rupert Sheldrake's theory was explained or gave some kind of scientific background or basis for his family field, knowing field. And so I got to know Bert Hellinger very well. But my work had a separate origin, through my work with sound and ancestors, and I spent time in Japan and was very interested in the role of the family altar in the heart of the house in traditional Japanese houses, where the, admittedly it's patriarchal, but the head of the family, the previous head of the family, had an ancestral altar, and every day fresh rice, fresh alcohol, and so forth, and whatever he liked, or is it he always what he drank, and so would be put on his altar. To honor the ancestors. And one of the things that happened in the tsunami, which not so many people know about, is that people actually died, you know, going into the water after their ancestral tablets. And also the ancestors were orphaned because, you know, a lot of the living were no longer present for them to look after them. So I became very, very interested in the role of the ancestors, you know, long before the tsunami. But that was a very interesting aspect, a very tragic aspect of the tsunami. So I've been working with family constellations now for well over 20 years and worked with many, many thousands of people.
Oh, wow. Wow. So do you think that, it seems like the music aspect or the harmonizing aspect is what really called you into the space of that deeper connection?
Yes, I mean, but I'd always been very interested in transgenerational patterns. So what I found was that working with sound in relation to the ancestors brought up the whole question of transmission of ancestral patterns and exclusions. And so my interest in these patterns combined with sound really got me going on it. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, you see that in a lot of cultures is the communal chanting in Native American Gregorian chants. You see that's a very typical thing to how to pass on information from one generation to the other is through sound. So it must be hardwired into who we are that has been traditionally the most common way of transferring information, right? Is that?
Well, I think so. I mean, we're resonant beings. You know, we're made of the regularities and periodicities. All our being, you know, the way we walk is a periodic, and our heartbeat and our breathing, it's all resonance. And you know, so when we chant, we're making our voices conscious. And so, as you say, it's deeply, I wouldn't say hardwired, but it's certainly resonant into the resonant system, without a doubt. Yes. And as you say, knowledge is passed on. And it's interesting, actually, in the ayahuasca communities, which is a lot of interest now, the beings that people perceive are often sonorous beings. And they do. They carry the traditions. They carry the information. They are the songs. The Icaros are actually, you know, the transmission of the teachings.
Oh, wow. So do you combine, have you combined the chanting with the ayahuasca ceremonies, and does that create a...
Well, I personally, you know, don't, that's not part of my work, but, you know, so I'm not sure this is the moment to discuss that, but that's not what I do. My work is very much, you know, working with sound, working with groups with no additional aids other than the voice itself, and working with family constellations. Yeah.
Do you find it people connect a little bit quicker when they're using the voice?
Yes.
When that seems like you know, you create the synergy, right? Of the moment.
It creates a coherence, and when you know with Family Constellations, when you're working with, I mean, I don't know how much your audience knows about Family Constellations, but when somebody's working, they choose from the group people to represent, depending what kind of family constellation you're doing. In my case, it's the family, so they would choose somebody to represent their mother, father, and siblings to begin with, and then we bring in other people. This sound creates a kind of coherence between them, you know, in the family itself, and brings about the kind of realization of the family field in a very, very tangible way, much more powerfully than without. Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine that especially the mother's voice would be such a conduit for happening. I remember as a child laying on my mother's stomach and listening to her voice through her body, and how of a deep connection that is. You know, as if you see that, even if you can record intentions through your mother's voice and then listen to that happening, it has a larger effect. That's
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you see as a kind of resonance down the family is handwriting, but also voices. Mm, so people's voices are sometimes quite similar to the voices of their parents or the people, or they're not necessarily just their birth parents actually, but also those who brought them up. I've worked with somebody who was brought up by a stepfather, and his voice is indistinguishable from the father that brought him up. So it's a kind of definite resonance that happens, you know, between people, which is just amazing.
And it's even the pattern of talking and the certain words, the phraseology and the pattern and the frequency and the tone, and it resonates in a lot of different ways. Even laughs. A lot of people say that I have my father's laugh. I laugh just like my father, and that connection is a profound connection that you don't necessarily realize at the beginning. You
know? Absolutely. Yeah,
that's incredible. And then, so do you believe that, or have you found in the past that do people get better at connecting through the voices? Do they does it once they start chanting that they're able to do that more often and connect?
Yes, I mean people. Problem? I mean I work. I mean in terms of the chanting now in general, I work with people who are from people who've been told to stand at the back and mouth it. You know, who've always been told they can't sing in tune, right up to very famous divas and opera singers. You know, and there's a funny thing about the voice. It doesn't matter how good you are. There's always somebody who's better than you, and so you're always aware comparing that. And I mean, I remember in one particular workshop where I was teaching the voice, I had a very famous opera singer, and then I had a kind of a retired opera singer, and then I had everybody else and people who couldn't sing or been told they couldn't sing in between. And it was very sweet that the opera singer was very you know aware of this, and so he sort of held back but yes, people get better at it because it's very much about, you know, you, if you're told to be at an early age you can't sing, then because to sing you need to show off and to let rip and you know and to listen, and when you hear you're told that you can't sing, then the last thing you're going to want to do is to listen. So the very things you need, you know, are an ability to listen and a desire to listen and also a desire to kind of show off. So people get better without a doubt when they realize that what they're doing is great and has nothing to do with, you know, traditional forms, but something much more profound, you know, a whole other level of order, which ordinary music doesn't have.
And it seems that's interesting that you said that, because what started coming up for me is that it's almost a back way into people connecting with themselves.
Oh, yes. Well, not even a back way. I mean, it's one of the most profound ways of meditating.
Yeah. You know?
Because if you're chanting, I mean, the whole point of meditation or any kind of practice is to be in the present, because, you know, we're always anxious about what we forgot to do and therefore plotting what we need to do in the future because we didn't do it in the past, and we need to do something in case the worst happens, and we're always trying to remain living. And so the point of all spiritual traditions is to be in the present. And it's not so easy to be in the present. But if you're chanting and you're listening to yourself chanting while you're chanting, you can only chant in the present.
Yeah.
And if at the same time as chanting in the present, you're listening in the present to yourself chanting in the present, then you're completely in the present. And yeah. you haven't got any bits of attention left to think about or strategize about what might, keep you on the planet longer. So it's the best way of meditating and learning to meditate. Yeah.
And connecting, right? It's like, because you have to listen to everybody that what everybody else is doing, and connecting with not only your physical body, but with that resonance, that collective consciousness, right? That everybody is participating at the same time.
I mean, that's, it dissolves sound. One of the things about sound, it dissolves the boundaries. Mm. It dissolves the boundaries between heaven and earth, between spirit and matter, between you and me, between my internal organs, between myself and the geometry of nature. So when you're chanting in a group, it dissolves the boundaries between people. And so you create and you sustain community like nothing else.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful way of creating community. And if you're going to do family constellations, then it's really powerful, because you're creating a group so that when you're they're naive representatives. You may never have met them before, although a lot of the people who work with me work again and again, so they do. But you have a naive representative. And so by chanting and creating this field, they're much more, it's much easier for them to tune into the field.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you can see that just like singing songs around the campfire, as colloquial as that sounds, is the same kind of concept, that you're gathering in a place and creating a field of community through voice. It's just one of the most powerful experiences that you can go. Even at a concert, everybody singing the same song, focusing all that attention into the same person, it seems.
But it's better. But I mean, what my work in a way has been about reclamation, so that we are doing the singing, not us going and attending when somebody else is doing the singing. But actually, reclaiming our voices and re-empowering ourselves and ourselves within community. Yeah.
You can see that in, after doing constellations for a while, you can see people doing a workshop on connecting with their voice.
Yeah.
Right. It's like that. And so it seems like a really great way to set up what the movement that's going to happen is to say, everybody is already starting from a place of connecting with their voice and connecting internally to be able to create the morphic field for healing, right? For set up the dynamic for moving forward.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And people, sometimes people actually sound like people they're representing, even though they've never met them.
Mm.
And of course, they say things that these people they've never met say. They become these people. I mean, one of the most interesting, I don't know how much people know about family constellations, but one of the things that somebody who's working does is to choose other people to represent their family members. One time I had two brothers who'd worked with me a lot, and one of them in particular had been studying music, and his brother was the kind of vulnerable one, and they were both doing the workshop. And for the first time, one of my sons was there as a representative, and he'd never done it before. And the less vulnerable brother chose my son, who was in his 20s at the time, to represent the other brother, who was also there. And I saw this process working as never before, because I could see him, his name is Cosmo, and I could see him when he was chosen to represent this other brother, he sort of crumpled, and he's a very cheery, person. And so I knew this wasn't him. Then I could see him saying internally, "This is ridiculous. I'm Cosmo," and sort of gathering himself together again. And then crumpling as he became this other person. And then, no, this is ridiculous. I'm Cosmo. And he went backwards and forwards between becoming this other person who was watching the process, and his rational mind kicking in and reclaiming him to be himself, until he realized that it was okay. And then he just let go and carried on as the other person. But it was the most graphic example, because he was my son, so I knew him really well. So it was the most graphic example of seeing the process of what it is when somebody becomes another person, and it's completely extraordinary, and we don't know how it works. We science is a kind of relative way of catching up with what actually happens, and we have no idea what's going on there, but you know, we know that it works extraordinarily well.
Yeah, to answer your question, the podcast is about family constellation, so all variations and methodologies, and this is just such an interesting take on it, you know, so to add the voice and the chanting on top of it. It's extraordinary. And what you were saying about your son was very similar to my first experiences. You know, my first experience, I was in Romania with a family constellation facilitator. And there was 55 psychologists and psychiatrists, and it was a whole week. And I think I was 25. So I was very young, in my early 20s. And, you know, I had gone with my mother and my sister, and my thought was that, when somebody explained it to me, my thought was that, everybody had learned, my mother had filled out a questionnaire, and everybody had learned my story, and that's how they knew. Right. And when I got picked to do my first representation, I was sold. I was like, this, whatever I'm feeling here is this deeper connection to something else, and I cannot explain it.
Yeah.
Interesting how you're in your mind and in the physical presence and field at the same time. So I totally resonate with his experience.
Well, I mean, usually I don't know the families of my students, you know, but on one occasion I did. And this person, so I knew his parents extremely well, as it happened. And he chose, for you know, naive representatives, for, although I happen to know them, they'd work with me a lot, to represent his parents. And it was, for me, extraordinary, because those people became this couple who I knew really well. I mean, they completely transformed into this couple who I happened to know. And it was hilarious. I mean, it was just so extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it, because normally you don't know the people that people are representing. But in this case, I did. And I just couldn't believe it, because actually I also knew the people that he'd chosen to represent, because they'd worked with me a lot. So I know what they're like, and they are not like these people that they became. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
It's incredible about the contrast of like the distilled essence of somebody, you know, like just a phraseology or how they behave. And you're like, that's who that person is. You know, it's almost this is kind of of an odd experience for me, but I was at my grandfather's deathbed, and I was literally there before and after he had transitioned, and I was looking at his body after he had passed. I'm like, that's not him.
Yeah,
the connection that he had to the consciousness that we all inhabit is no longer there. He's returned to that place again, and it's so interesting to have the before and after of those things and the context of what those two dynamics are. It's incredibly powerful.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, it's so mysterious. We have, you know, any kind of attempts we have in science to explain any of these things is, you know, it's all names and labels, and we really have no idea. And I mean, you know, when the gravitational field was discovered, I mean, you know, nobody knew. Newton didn't know what was going on. He just saw the effects, and you described the effects. And so that's what fields are. You know, people describe the effects of a field, but, you know, nobody knows what it really is, you know.
The best way that I've been able to explain it is it almost happens in between the lines. It's like it happens when you don't look at it, you know, try to look at, once you look at it, it's like, it's not happening. Then you look away and you can see the after effects of the cluster of data that's happening. And that's very, very, very powerful. Do you gravitate more towards the phenomenological side or towards the more, I guess, psychological science-based? Because you seem like you have this beautiful mesh of the two. That between your experience with your husband and you, your kind of spiritualistic or shamanic side is, I guess, the best way that I could explain it is, you seem like you have this beautiful merger of both those two worlds.
Yes, I do. And I did a research fellowship in the biophysics departments with, you know, one of the three that got the Nobel Prize for DNA, you know, in the 70s. I worked with him in the 70s. So, yes, I do have both. I have many sides. You know, I have the spiritual side, the scientific side, and the artistic side, and the musical side. And yeah. You know, my mother was a concert pianist. My father was a surgeon, you know. So I it's all there, but when I'm working with family constellations, I tend in general to stick with the family and see what's going on with the family. I don't really do it in terms of organizations, institutions. I'm much more interested in working with the family, and people come again and again because, you know, they treat it like therapy. So if they have a problem, they come and then it's transformed immediately. I mean, it's instantaneous.
It's incredible how fast the effect of it is.
Yeah, it's instant. I mean, sometimes people come and say they've been trying for years to have a baby, and I don't seem blah, 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 and they go, you know, they do a workshop with me, and they go away and have a baby, or yeah. I'm looking for a man, and I've been searching for years. You know, they yeah. come and do a constellation with me, and they go out and find the man of their dreams. I mean, I don't know how it works. It's amazing, but it really is. Instantaneous.
Yeah,
that's the, you know, what I love about constellations is that you're working in the present to transform the past and the future. So it's kind of timeless in a way, and also it's beyond space because you're working from, you see the family through the eyes of all members, you know, through time and space. Yeah. So there isn't a kind of limited view that we normally have of anything, and so you're beyond time and space. And you see it through the eyes of everybody, you know, like that film Rashomon, where the film is made up of an event that happens in the forest. I don't know if you know that.
No, I'm not familiar with
a very famous Japanese film. By Kurosawa called Rashomon, and there's an event that happens. There's a woman on a horse and a samurai, and there's a woodsman, and somebody gets killed. And being Japanese, everybody sort of claims the murder, you know. Mm. So you see the film is divided into the same event happening, seen through the eyes of the woman on the horse, the samurai, and the woodsman. Each one is the reality, you know. So there isn't, you can't say this happened or that happened. Each one is its own reality. And that's what it's like with the family constellations. Everybody, you know, I love working with families because, you know, I once worked with three sisters, you know, one after the other, you know, and you wouldn't know it was the same family because each one saw it through the eyes of their own eyes. And so the others could see it through the eyes of the person who was working.
Yeah.
It's really one of the extraordinary things about family constellations is this going beyond space and time and the instantaneous effect that has.
That's the way I always described it is almost seeing the Matrix. You know, you can see you can see beyond the current present reality. You can see all realities and all dimensions of what things are happening.
And when I'm working, I really get into the zone. I get into a totally other kind of way of being, you know, the other thing about family conversations, you can't have an idea. Well, in the way I work, I feel I never have an idea about what could or would happen or might happen.
Yeah.
But it's a constant revelatory exposure in the moment that it is happening.
Yeah.
And I get these kind of huge feelings inside when I know that this is, I've seen what's going on. You know, it's like this huge, it's, you can't, if you try and strategize and say, well, if this, then that, or if that, then this, the work stops dead. And it's the same with the people. If they try and control it, I want to work with my mother's line and da, 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 and I want to do this, that, the other, the work stops because they miss what's really happening.
Yeah.
So it's what I love about it is it only works if you're in the present. You know, if I, as the guide, I'm completely in the present with no concepts about what might or could or should happen. There's no should, there's no advice, there's no, it's just about, you know, dancing with the revelation of the presence in its revelatory moment and guiding, dancing with that. It's glorious.
Yeah, it really is. And one of my favorite things to see is when the facilitator is sitting and says, so, you know, they've set the movements happened, right? And so they've seen everybody. And then kind of the client looks at the facilitator, and the facilitator, you know, it's like, let's find out. And so they find out together what's happening and kind of, and can pull those things apart and tease the things and find where the dynamics lie. It's just such a beautiful process. And it's so vulnerable. It's,
yeah.
It's really being in a state of vulnerability. And that's so beautiful about it.
Yeah. And that's what's good, you know, working in a group, because you have that mutual vulnerability,
which is
so healing and so powerful. I mean, I don't do it exactly like Hellinger. I mean, most of the people who do this work, you know, have been taught by Hellinger or somebody who's been taught by Hellinger. I mean, I've worked with Hellinger and I know knew him very well indeed, because, you know, he was such a fan of my husband. So he'd always come and visit when he was in England and so on. But the way I do it is slightly different, because I didn't learn it from him. You know, I developed my own way of working. And for me, it's very important to do it ceremonially. You know, I not only use sound, but between each person, I have this ceremonial sort of setup, I find very important, you know, to do that, because with ceremony, you have you always have the witness, you know, and the power of the witness is very important, because you can do something and you can change. But then when you go back into your own community, they don't know you've changed.
Because
as far as they're concerned, yours is. So they treat you the same way. But if you've had somebody who's witnessed you going from here to there, and then they know that you know that they know that you know, then it's a very different thing. And it's much harder to go back and go back into your old way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I noticed that you have, what I'm hearing is that you incorporate traditions into it, right? So like cultural traditions into the type of work that you do. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, that's a very tricky thing to say these days, you know, because people are very sort of hot about that. But I've spent 45 years studying Dzogchen within the Tibetan tradition, very much, I mean, in the past I studied all kinds of ways of meditating and practice, but then I found a teacher and spent, you know, 45 or more years studying Dzogchen within Tibetan Buddhism. And so there's no question that understanding comes through my work. I mean, what would be the point if it didn't?
You know?
In that case, definitely.
And have you integrated other traditions into that as well? Or just, not necessarily... like there's universal truths and things, right? Have you integrated other traditions into those universal truths?
But all spiritual traditions, build on the previous one, you know, that's what they do. I mean, that's the nature of spiritual traditions in every culture. You know, you have these layers, these strata, you know, so you have these shamanic stratas, and you have the big religions coming in and sweeping through and gathering up other traditions. And so, you know, in terms of spiritual traditions, it's fundamental that you have these different strata, and that's what they are. You know, you can't get away from it, but it's very tricky, you know, talking about it, because people are, you know, so worried about it. And so it's very important to acknowledge those traditions. So I tend to, hard to say really.
That's the thing that I'm starting to realize is, once you start looking at things softly without judgment, you can see the benefits of all of it, right? As you start seeing those traditions like a morphic field, you know, like a ancestral, those ancestral traditions come with, you know, there's information in them that's embedded. So you could say that they could almost be a vision into the past of things that have resonated over long periods of time, and those patterns that have happened and have been carried on and passed on to other people. So there should be value in it. I know
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And, you know, hopefully the understanding and the coming into presence is common to all traditions.
Yeah. Coming into presence. Yeah. Wow. So what's, where do you think the evolution of the voice work is gonna lead to? Is that something that you're teaching a lot of people how to do? Teaching other people how to facilitate that type of voice work and integrating that into the workshops?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been doing it for an embarrassingly long time. You know, I've been teaching since the, the sort of late 70s. Yeah. And I've taught thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And I started the whole sort of movement of the healing voice. I call it the healing voice. Nobody was working with it, you know, before I started. And I taught in America for years and Canada for years and in Europe for years. And so I started that whole movement. And then when I started doing family constellations, you know, about 20 years ago, then again, incorporating the voice, it came out of working with the voice. Yeah. So I've taught many, many people over the years.
I'm so happy that you guys were doing that because it led to kind of my generation starting to pick up on that stuff. And I'm eternally grateful because I really do truly believe that this is the way to reconcile a lot of the dynamics that have gotten us to this place. It's just,
absolutely,
you know, it really, I'm just kind of flattered by, you know, the people that have come before me and before us to, you know, that doing the hard work, because I bet that wasn't easy to do when in the early 70s or late 80s to say, let's do this work that is extraordinarily profound, and we're going to uncover some things that you're not going to necessarily, that are not going to feel good, and we can resolve these dynamics. I can't imagine how difficult that was during that time.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, people wondered what on earth I was up to, you know, when I started, but I never questioned it. I've never questioned anything that I was doing. And, but one of the other things I love about family constellations is that, versus something like talking therapy, which I think is not so, it's cathartic maybe, but with talking therapy, because talking is always within the rational domain, you know, by definition, you know, you're talking about the past and the future, and language is linear. And, but most of our problems, most of our kind of crazinesses and weirdnesses and dysfunctionalities and patterns are way down in the unconscious, and we have no means of getting to them. And that's why I think this work with sound amplified family constellations, you can really drill down very very quickly and very deeply and access these very, very deep unconscious patterns and work with them. And I think it's extraordinary.
It's almost jump-starting the constellation by connecting directly with the ancestry.
Yeah.
Because sometimes in a little bit more traditional constellations, people are so inside their head that they don't see the immediate connection or haven't done constellations. And I've been very fortunate that, that I've taken friends to family constellations, and they're like, what is this, man? You know, like guys from the military, from work, or from, you know, just childhood friends, you know, very much in their mind, and immediately connect. And I would say that it's almost like jumpstarting that or getting a head start on that by connecting with the voice. I see it as such a tremendous impact. I would love to learn more about it. It's just, it's connecting directly to that pipeline, you know?
And I always, when I'm doing workshops with family constellations, I always start by doing at least one, usually two ceremonies to the ancestors, first of all, to get the ancestors on board.
Wow.
So I always start with that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's at the first workshop that I did, they were doing Gregorian chants? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So it was very much of getting into that meditative space of just kind of everybody listening to the same thing. And then we would kind of emerge from that and then be ready to work, to open space, you know.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that's powerful. So how do you connect kind of your husband's work and what you're doing now? How do you merge those two things together in your teachings? Is that something that that you integrate, or is that
Well, we do workshops together, not very often, but sometimes. Oh, wow. But our work is very related. I mean, his theory of morphic resonance is based on a metaphor of resonance, whereas I'm working with the real thing, the real resonance.
Yes, exactly.
And so, and you know, the followers of Bert Hellinger are very, very keen on his work because of, you know, the way that Bert so liked his theory of morphic resonance, because it's the only scientific theory which really does you know, corroborate the family work, the ancestral work. And so so he's often asked, and was, you know, often asked by Bert or by people who work with Bert to to give seminars or have conversations or so no, our work is very, very related. We come at it from very different angles, but we're, you know, we're definitely onto the same kind of thing, which is, I see the family conversation as a kind of induction of order, really, of coherence and order, which is why the sound is so important in it as well. So it's only when everybody, all the family and ancestors are in their rightful place, you know, all the sort of dodgy ones who were excluded are brought back and honored, and you know, everybody finds their place and nobody's excluded, nobody's forgotten, yeah. that you have this sort of order of love that comes in, and everybody, there's this sort of mutual kindness, acknowledgement, there are no outliers, nobody's forgotten. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is very much about bringing order within the morphic field. You know, it's very similar concept, yeah. In a sense.
It's almost like playing a song without all the chords. You know, it doesn't sound right. It just doesn't. And you've been playing that your whole life, and this doesn't sound right. And it doesn't resolve. You know, when you have words that resolves and it feels the same. I'm a musician, so I'm. It's very much. I've always been. I play guitar, and you know, I sing, and so it's.
Okay.
It very much resolves, and even writing songs comes from a different place. It's it's like the. It just bubbles up from when you're connected, you know.
Actually, that resolution is very interesting because, you know, sometimes when I see other people doing family constellations, I see them trying to force it and struggle. I mean, I haven't seen a whole lot of other people, but you know, enough, and I can see them trying to force something into, you know, force it into place, into some kind of concept that they have of how it ought to be. And like shoehorning it into place. And, and I think, no, don't do that. You know, you have to sort of allow the order to come into being.
Yeah.
And you can't force it. You know, you can't, you just have to allow the whole process of order to come in and seeing how that's possible. But you can never force it or control it or
yeah.
That just stops the work. And
yeah. Yeah. Try and put a round peg in a square hole. It just doesn't happen.
Right. But when you get it right, when you allow that, then that feeling of resolution is that's what made me think of it. That feeling of resolution is so exquisite. You know,
it's undeniable.
Yeah. You know, you've got it. That's it.
Yeah.
It's so funny because, you know, I've been working for years and years and years, and then with COVID and isolation, you know, I can't do physical workshops anymore until such a time as we can. And so I've developed a way of doing them online, which I think is, you know, quite extraordinary and works really powerfully.
It really does.
I've only done two. I've got the third one coming up in September. Each one has got so much better than the last.
Mm.
But in the last one, I had somebody who's worked with me many, 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 many times. And finally, it was in the online one that we got to the crunch and the heart of what, you know, sometimes it takes a few to get really to get to the issue.
Yeah.
And she said, I've been working on that for 50 years. Oh, finally. and that was doing it online, which is...
Yeah.
And I've now found a way of bringing in the chant online. You know, before I had to hold the chant and people would turn off their mics because you can't have a group chant online because everybody's different connections, speeds, and it doesn't work. It sounds horrible. And so now I've just found a way of bringing in the chant so that we can all chant together. So that's really good too.
It's I've never seen a more, I guess, real example of, I guess, the irrelevance of time and space than in the Zoom calls. It's like you're doing the Zoom call and you change the person's name to whatever they're representing.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we have, so I'm based in South Florida, in Miami, basically.
Excuse me.
And we have bless you. We have a group down here and we do these Zoom calls and there's people in Australia, there's people all over the world, South Africa, in Europe, and they're all over the world, and the connection is immediate. It's just space and time is irrelevant in that.
Isn't it great? I know. I find that too. I mean, I had, you know, in the last two, I had people in New Zealand, Australia, America, East Coast, West Coast, Europe, everyone under the sun. And as you say, because the work is beyond space and time, so doing it on Zoom is even more on space and time. And, you know, it's just as it's real.
It's real. Yeah. It's real. Yeah. That's the thing that I'm kind of curious about. Is there is, you know, our besides your husband doing the research that he's been doing for so long.
We should perhaps mention his name because maybe
your husband, Rupert Sheldrake. Okay. So it's incredible how he's been doing this for so long and kind of bringing this to light. And then there's these practical examples and repeatable, measurable experiments that happen all over the world at all times that all these people and facilitators are doing on a regular basis. It's really incredible that's happening and can be repeated and measured. You know, like that's the thing that I can't. It's undeniable that this is happening. You know, you can see it immediately. You know, I remember watching a video saying about the packs of wolves that have the morphic field that's connecting them, and then the birds, you know, and or sardines evading predators. It's the same connection. It's the exact
flocks you can take and that. Shells of fish and flocks of birds and
absolutely.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really incredible. Are there experiments that are happening on that side, or are there people doing research, like larger groups doing research on trying to find out
he's doing a lot of experiments. He's basically experimentalist, so he's doing experiments all the time. He's got people designing apps and, you know, doing all kinds of things. And he's also very interested in kind of telepathy and, you know, a wider sense of the field you know, how people interact in that way. So, you know, he's doing experiments all the time.
Oh wow! Yeah, that's the I've gone kind of all sides of this, right? When I started, it was very much on the psychological side, more, you know, Bert Hellinger on the spiritual side when Sophie started, you know, they started making the move together. Was it Science of Mind? Was the kind of the change? And it was so, you know, kind of like psychological, right? And then
I was there actually when he, not exactly, I think he'd met her, but he did a kind of constellation with her in Cognito as a demonstration. So I think they just met actually when this.
Oh wow!
And but I never after they got together, I never really saw him working, and so I don't know in what way. I mean, I know she kind of privatized the whole thing slightly, but Rupert has given many talks for her and gone to her conferences, but I haven't seen how the work changed when she came on the scene. So how is that? How would you describe that change?
So I would say that the two kind of methodologies, or there was the pre and post, and the pre was very psychological, right? Was based on Jungian psychology and kind of connecting and uncovering those patterns, right? So like a good example is Mark Wolin. He's an author, wrote a book called It Didn't Start With You. Yeah, and it's very much based on the psychology of it. And then there's the kind of spiritual side that is very ritualistic and in traditions, deeply rooted in traditions. And that has its intricacies and beauty to it as well. And then there's the organizational side with guys like Jan Jacob Stam that does a systemic organizational side. And then there's even structural constellations that Matthias von Kiebit is a German that is almost like his methodology is almost like doing physics. It's almost like doing physics formulas. And you can like, okay, this is X and let's finish the equation and try to figure it out. And it's just there's so many beautiful aspects to, it's like different versions of the same methodology. It's just, it's wonderful. I'm just very passionate about finding the different versions of the same recipe. You know what I mean? It's really, really interesting.
Well, I remember it wasn't until later that I realized, but I remember in, I think it was 81, I was at a conference lecturing, and Virginia Satir was there. She was one of the sort of, I suppose she was a kind of one of the founders in a way, but she hers was much more about play acting, you know.
Absolutely.
Role play. You
the
know.
Drama, yeah, the drama.
The drama. And I think it sort of developed from the Gestalt and the drama, and that's really how it began.
Yeah.
But except that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's representing is very, very different from role play. You know, what role play, you're trying to be somebody, whereas representing, you become them, and it's very, very different. Early theatre must have been much more like representing, you know.
Sure
the original theatre would have been people becoming their role rather than trying to act something else.
It seems like good actors, that's what they're able to do.
Yes, I'm sure. They
connect to that essence of who that is. It's I would imagine very similar in the behavior or the adaptation of what that is. It's very similar then, because you can tell when somebody's acting or somebody is, you know, and that's that. In Constellations, you can see that immediately. It's like, oh, that person's acting, and or that's actually that, and so you can. Yeah, body pains of where things are happening. I feel uncomfortable and I feel the pain, and it's immediate.
Yeah.
And then you can also see when somebody's entangling their own stuff into it as well.
Also, I mean, another thing which happens very rarely, but I think probably in all the thousands of Constellations I've done, it probably happened about twice, that the person working, their story is complete nonsense. You know, it's completely fabricated, you know, and you can, and the whole room is zinging with inauthenticity. And it's agony. Everybody knows that it's
everybody not,
what they're talking nonsense, isn't it? They're just fabricating this whole story. It's so rare, fortunately, that happens. But it's so interesting, the feeling you get when you do witness that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you can, the beauty of it as well is it's profound truth, and you can't hide things. You know, I mean, I've seen also in some workshops is like when somebody does something that they're not they like if a facilitator tries to do something that they have that the client has no control over. It's like this isn't gonna. You have this line doesn't.
Yeah.
There's no connection here that the representative will physically not do.
Yeah.
Even if the facilitator would like, even if it's a horrible case or some, you know, some horrible situation, and they can't. It's there's nothing we can do here. Oh, it's so angry. You know, like such. Profound anguish in those situations.
No, you can't force it. That's what's so elegant and so you know, it's such a good feeling when the whole thing is flowing and authentic and you know you're just riding this wave of revelation, and it's glorious.
I've one of the ways I used to describe it is like seeing a sushi chef. You know, they just very elegantly use their tools to make everything perfectly ordered and it's where it's supposed to be and packaged correctly. And it's just, it really has. And I don't know how else to put it. It just has this resolution to it. It's like, you're building tension in a song and it resolves. It's like,
You
know, I'm getting, you know, like goosebumps even just kind of talking about it. It's just such a powerful, powerful, powerful moment. It really
is. Indeed. Yes.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
It really is. Jill, I just
wanted to say about science, which is very interesting, is you know, I mentioned that I worked with one of the three who got the Nobel Prize for DNA. And at that point in the early 70s, it was 71, everybody thought that everything was inherited in the DNA. Now the hot subject in science is epigenetics, which is the inheritance of acquired characters. And so this was really discovered by people who were working with the Holocaust or the famine in Holland after the war or any of these racial traumas. They found that, you know, there were physical, chemical, and as well as psychological effects in the descendants of these people. And so that's now become the hot subject in science. And so, you know, it's always a question of science catching up.
Exactly. I mean, that's usually how it is, right? We all thought that, you know, as a human race, we thought that, everything revolved around the earth. And then we found out very quickly otherwise, you know. It's just, it's so cool to see science catching up to what we know and we are experiencing on a regular basis.
Yeah.
That's so powerful.
Well, I mean, I hope some of your group will come and join me online. My third one is in September, the 11th, okay. 12th and 13th.
Oh, September. And where can they find you on the...
So they can find me on my website, healingvoice.com.
Healingvoice.com.
Healingvoice.com. Okay. And you can enroll on the homepage. It's up there. Okay. September 11th, 12th and 13th. And I do 3 hours on the Friday,
okay.
And 5 hours on the Saturday with an hour's break, and okay. 5 hours on the Sunday with an hour's break.
Okay.
And so that's in September coming up, and I hope people will join me. So it's on. You can enroll from the homepage on my Eventbrite, or you can call me up however you like. Yeah.
Okay. Is there an email that they should contact you on, or?
Yes, it's info@healingvoice.com.
Okay. Beautiful.
So to repeat that, info@healingvoice.com.
Okay.
And healing voice is one word. Yeah.
And are you on the social media platforms like Instagram or Facebook? And
I'm on Instagram. I have two, one under Healing Voice and one under my name, Jill Purse.
Okay.
Jill with a J and Purse with a C, P-U-R-C-E. So I have two Instagram pages, and I have under the same name, Facebook. But most of the information, best information is on my website, healingvoice.com. There's masses of information on there, a lot of interviews and, you know, articles, everything, masses.
Wonderful.
And a means for them to join me in September.
Yeah, that would be great. I would very much love to attend. I think that would be wonderful. Also, Jill, if you ever want to come down to South Florida, we have a great community down here that we do consultations on a regular basis, training. Mm-hmm. We invite people from all over the world. So we'd love to, you know, I lived in England for 2 years, so I know what your winters are like. Yeah. So if you ever want to warm your bones, this is the place to do it. So
okay, well, when travel becomes possible again.
Yeah, exactly. It may be January, just in time, you know, like January beginning of spring, but yeah, hopefully fingers crossed that's the case. But we'd love to have you. Thank you so much for being a guest today. It's just you have a wonderful take on this type of work and very much appreciate everything that you're doing. It's you know, laying the path for people, you know, across the world and training and it really is the work that's needed now, especially with the climate that's happening now, everything that's all the dynamics that are happening. It's very powerful work. So
yeah. Great. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye. We'll talk soon.
Bye.